Good morning, members. I call this meeting of the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee to order. We are meeting remotely under House Rule 10.01. We will start with the roll. Anna, please go ahead.
Chair Beckerson.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Frazier.
Present.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Hurt.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Johnson. Representative Liebling.
Here.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Mortensen.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Fang. Representative Zhang.
Present.
And Representative Scott.
Present.
Sorry, I got so excited after passing all those bills out of committee last night. First up, we will, a quorum is present. We will move to approval of the minutes for March 8th. Representative Feist, would you move the minutes of March 8th, 2021?
Yes, so moved, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you, Representative Feist. Any discussion to the minutes? All right, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Great, the minutes are approved for March 8th, 2021. Members, we have 9 bills on the agenda today. We'll try to get through as many as we can this morning, so hopefully we aren't keeping you guys too late when we come back at 5 o'clock. First on the agenda today is House File 7 from Representative Olson. Just as a reminder, this is the Earned Sick and Safe Time bill, but we will stick to the provisions of the bill that are under this committee's jurisdiction. It was noted in the posting if there's any questions about that. With that, I will move your bill, Representative Olson. I will move that House File 7 be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. Your bill is now before us. Please tell us about House File 7, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So House File 7 is the Earned Sick and Safe Time legislation. And so we know Minnesotans care for one another. Sorry, my 17-year-old cat just decided now is the time to be active. So if you hear something, it's not a child crying, it's a cat. Anyway, so House File 7, let's start again. Minnesotans care for one another, and we want Minnesota to be a caring state where all our families can be healthy and safe. So I'm carrying this bill because everyone gets sick, and the coronavirus outbreak is another stark reminder that when people get sick, they should be able to stay home, not just for their own health or that of a loved one, but for the health of all of us. This bill would ensure that Minnesota is a state where, regardless of the color of your skin, your income, or where you work, you can afford to take the time off to recover from an illness at home where you can limit its spread, where a sick child can have the comfort of their parent caring for them, where you can go to the doctor before your illness goes from bad to worse, where you can seek support in the wake of a sexual assault, and where those things don't mean you need to worry about missing a bill or losing your job. Unfortunately, for far too many, especially those we've called essential during this pandemic, this isn't the Minnesota they experience. An estimated 36% of working people, that's about 932,000 Minnesotans, don't have any paid sick and safe time. This means that in a state with the second most Fortune 500 companies per capita, more than a third of working people in our state face a terrible choice between caring for themselves or a loved one in need and a loss of wages or even employment, because in many circumstances, it is still legal for workers to be fired for needing to take time off to care for themselves or a loved one. In keeping with what we've seen in more than a dozen states and numerous localities, local municipalities across the country, where very similar proposals have been passed, including my own city of Duluth, plus Minneapolis and St. Paul, providing access to earned sick and safe time also brings benefit to employers through improved recruitment and retention, lower employee health costs through better use of preventative care, and lower presenteeism or coming to work sick, all of which means higher productivity, fewer workplace injuries, and a healthier workforce and state. To the committee's jurisdiction, Today, we are looking at provisions in Article 2, starting on page 10 of the bill, which create and enhance the enforcement mechanisms the Department of Labor and Industry will need to ensure that workers and employers are protected under this bill. Specifically, Sections 1 and 3 increase the maximum penalties for both the refusal to turn over records and for repeated and willful violations. This gives DALI increased flexibility to address those cases where they are being stonewalled or where the existing civil penalties are clearly insufficient. Refusing to turn over records that show a violation may have incurred should not stand as a valid defense against DALI investigation of a complaint. Under already existing statute, in determining the amount of a civil penalty under this subdivision, the appropriateness of such a penalty to the size of the employer's business and the gravity of the violation shall be considered. Section 2 applies to DALI's existing compliance order authority to sick and safe time, and Section 4, Subdivision 3, creates a private right for individuals to alternatively bring a civil action to recover damages under this bill. So ultimately, House File 7 is about becoming the kind of caring state that I think we all want Minnesota to be. And with that, I'm happy to turn it over to, I believe I have one testifier, Ray Perez, could speak to the bill, and I'll be happy to take questions.
Okay, Ray, if you could introduce yourself for the committee and then go ahead with your testimony.
All right, good morning, everyone. My name is Ray Perez. I am an education student at St. Paul State University, where I work two on-campus jobs at the Child Care Center and with Res Life. I also do housekeeping at a local hotel on weekends. So I'm a full-time college student working essentially three part-time jobs. My mom works as a medical receptionist and retail worker, and my dad is employed at a local food plant. And if there's one thing that my parents taught me is my strong work ethic. And as the eldest of five, I've had to take responsibility at a young age. And if my experience taught me one thing, it was that my labor was required to pay bills, yet I never received a single paycheck. My youngest brother has severe asthma, where he spent many winter nights before bedtime connected to a nebulizer to allow him to breathe easier while he slept. If the weather was too harsh, my parents refused to take him out in the cold, even for the few minutes it would take to put him in the car to take him to daycare. My parents could not risk staying home from work because they worried about losing their jobs. And as the eldest, I was asked to stay home from school to babysit. This started from when I was 12 to when I graduated high school. And as my sisters got older, we would alternate just depending on who could stay home. I love my family, and I would do anything to help them. And we survived because we had our own support system. But one thing I've always wondered is how strong is the system if it requires children to be pulled out of schools? As the oldest child, a child care worker, and teacher in training, I know it is not enough to have rules. So these rules need to be enforced. We need earned sick and safe time, and workers need confidence that the policy will be enforced, that sick time will be honored, and we won't lose our jobs if we have earned sick and safe time. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ray. With that, we will move on to committee discussion. Any questions to the relevant provisions in the bill? Representative Scott.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. And I just had some questions and some concerns about some of the data provisions, actually, and the fact that I just wonder how many employees are going to want to turn over like private medical information or police reports regarding a possible, you know, a sexual assault or whatever to their employer. And that's what this bill says. If they go three or more days receiving safe and sick time, then the employer may require that information. And I worry about that having a chilling effect on people. Because who wants their employer to know that information? I'm not going to raise my hand for that. So I have concerns over that. I guess if the author just wants to address that, if she has any feedback from folks or if she has any concerns herself about that section of the bill.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott, for that question. I think that is why in Article 1, Section 4, Subdivision 13, we did put in some data privacy protections there to make sure that all information that employees share with their employer is confidential. And because we did want to honor that there takes that in there. And so that's part of what we wanted to do. And I mean, it'd be great, ideally. I mean, personally, I would also say if we didn't have to require documentation and employers took their employees' word and trusted them at good faith, that would be also excellent. And if that's something, you know, we could certainly talk more offline about that. But I think employees or employers really wanted that documentation of their employees. So we tried to strike a balance here with protecting their privacy while also making sure employers could get what they needed from their employees.
Follow-up, Representative Scott.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for your feedback on that, Representative Olson. And I'm sorry, my dog is whining because we're getting carpet on the stairs and she's not out there with them. So I'm sorry for the background noise. I still do have concerns about that. And let me ask you this. When a person has to take time off due to illness, you know, sick days, whatever, and if they have to go over and above those, do they have to report or give documentation to an employer now?
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Scott. That's a good question, and I know we have three different ordinances in effect across the state, and different employers have their own policies, so I wouldn't be able to speak to that specifically, but obviously what we're trying to do is set a floor here to have this requirement across that would set that floor, and obviously people could go above and beyond with what they do in their local municipalities or what, but this would be the baseline of what we'd expect all employers to do.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's one of my huge concerns.
All right. Next on the list, Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Olson. I have some concerns on this, just on the amount the fine is going up. Right now, it's a $1,000 fine. And a lot of these small businesses with 21 employees or less, a $1,000 fine can actually put them out of business, let alone a $10,000 fine. What can you explain the reason why you jumped 1,000% in the possible fine from 1,000 to 10,000?
Representative Olson with a math question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson. So as I mentioned in the opening testimony here for that, this is the maximum penalty. This isn't it has to be this penalty. It gives, you know, Dolly some flexibility to really look into, you know, seeing what the case is. And so it's not that this will absolutely happen. It's the ability to leverage a maximum penalty if there is some malicious or, you know, bad actors going on in this situation, that they would have a little bit more tools in their toolbox for enforcement. But again, it's really looking at it case by case and having the opportunity to really give Dolly what they need in order to determine. And currently in state statute, in determining the amount of civil penalty under this subdivision, the appropriateness of such penalty to the size of the employer's business and the gravity of the violation shall be considered. So we already have that to your point, Representative Johnson, would take into consideration the size of the business and the gravity of the violation.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, members, Representative Olson, that still bothers me. We had a bill the other day dealing with bail. And wanting to lower or add some things in to adjust the bail to get it to a proper level. But what they wanted to put in was already in statute. So I have a lot of concerns about the size of this fine. It's way out of sight. I have a lot of other concerns with this bill, but it's not in the purview of this committee, so I won't ask those questions. We'll be asking them on the floor of the House. But I think this is just giving, with the fines, it's just giving too much authority to the department. And I think it's going to just chase businesses out of Minnesota. We're already having businesses leave Minneapolis that to have these ordinances. They're leaving the city, going to other places. And I think it'll just, something like this is going to chase businesses out of Minnesota. Thank you.
All right. Next up, the member from Minneapolis, Representative Long.
Thank you, Chair Baker-Finn. And I'm unaware, Representative Johnson, of a business that's left Minneapolis in response to their earned sick and safe time policy. But if you're familiar with one, I'd love to talk to them. Representative Olson, I really appreciate you bringing this bill forward. And thank you so much to our testifier, Ms. Perez, for really putting a human face on the needs for this policy and for the needs to help protect workers when they're sick and when they need to care for their loved ones or their family. And I just wanted to note on the penalty provisions, you mentioned, Representative Olson, that those are a maximum. And it seems to me that the failure to submit records is a really problematic circumstance for the Department of Labor and Industry, where they often wouldn't be able to verify at all, what the compliance is with a business. And so I would think that some businesses, unfortunately, may do that to try to avoid the possibility of acknowledging that they aren't following the rules. And so it feels like $1,000 for some businesses really could just be seen as the cost of doing business. And I'm wondering if that was part of the concern for raising the fine amount.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Long. Yeah, so again, the language is that it would be repeated or willful violation. So in order to make sure that you're complying, you have to turn over your documents. And if we need to be able to make sure those documents get turned over so that Dolly can see those to make sure businesses are providing this benefit. I think as the testifier explained, it's great to have the benefit, but we need to make sure employers are actually adhering to it. And again, it's an up to, and again, it's the repeated or willful violation. So I think you're exactly right, Representative Long.
All right, we will go to Representative Robbins, and then we'll give Representative Scott, raise your hand again, and then we'll go to the vote. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Olson. I have a lot of questions, like Representative Johnson said, but I'm trying to limit it to this committee jurisdiction. So one of the questions I had was about the individual remedy. Is there any other place in employment law where we provide this civil action regarding like a benefit like this?
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Robbins. That's a good question. I don't know off the top of my head, but I don't know. We do have Dolly on the line too that could answer questions about that. And again, I just go back to the spirit of what we're trying to accomplish through like the provisions we're seeing in committee is it's great to have this benefit, but we need to make sure we have the right tools to enforce it to protect workers and make sure that they actually get the earned sick and safe time that they rightfully earn. And so that's the spirit of it. And again, just I think the testifier did a really great job talking about that piece, but I could turn it over to staff to answer that question.
I think I'm actually going to go to House Research since I'm guessing Dolly only knows about what happens within Dolly. So I believe Mary Mullen, are you the right researcher? And if not, maybe we've got someone else on.
Chair and members, this is Mary Mullen. I haven't looked into whether like what other statutes would have a similar enforcement provision, but I can look into it and get back to you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Mullen, if you could do that. I know it's kind of a broad question that was asked, about civil remedies. There's a lot of different areas of law where that could be. So if you could provide that to Ms. Ghanani, we can share that with the committee. Any follow-up questions, Representative Robbins?
Thank you, Chair Baker-Finn. And to Ms. Mullen, really, I'm looking for civil penalties tied to benefits. So hopefully that narrows the scope for you. Sorry. And I did have one more question about this grant program. So I'm interested in that as well. A lot of money to grants for community organizations to help employees. And it doesn't seem like there's a similar program that would help employers understand their responsibilities. So I'm wondering, A, why is it necessary to have those grant programs at all? Can't Dolly just do both sides of that equation? And then secondly, you reference in there a hotline that would be set up, but I found it interesting that you had specifically mentioned set up a hotline, but it's not tied to any of the groups. So could you talk a little bit more about what your intention is of who is going to run that hotline?
And Representative Robbins, those would be great examples of things that I bet were covered in the Labor Committee and are not within the jurisdiction of this committee, but I am absolutely sure that Representative Olson will follow up with you directly to get you some answers to those questions. So I know
apologies.
It's challenging.
I thought I was in the same right section. It's in Section 4, but I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Yeah, no problem. And then we'll go to Representative Scott, and then we'll move to the vote.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to say, in response to Representative Long's accusation that no businesses have left Minneapolis due to their sick and safe time policy, first of all, I don't know that we know
Scott,
that.
Representative Scott, just a second here. There was no accusation. He just said to his knowledge that there were none that he was aware of and was happy to speak with any if Representative Johnson wanted to share that information. So let's just keep it straight what was actually said.
All right. So my concern, Madam Chair, is that if you pile on this along with local minimum wage ordinances, along with the wage theft ordinance, along with COVID and what that's done, who's going to pay the taxes in Minneapolis? Because these businesses are leaving, and they're closing their doors. And so you just keep piling on regulation after regulation, and they will leave, and they are leaving. Many of them have already closed their doors, and I doubt they'll ever come back. So we have to be very careful about what we do here, because it does have an effect, with the pile-on effect especially. So, Madam Chair, that was my final comment. I'm going to urge my members not to vote for this bill today because of those reasons. Thank you.
All right. Representative Olson, final words.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the great discussion. And so I'll just close by saying, no matter where you live, your job, or the color of your skin, through our differences, we want many of the same things. We want to snuggle with our kids when they feel sick. We want to see the doctor before an illness goes from bad to worse. We want to be able to recover from the flu without worrying about missing bills or losing our jobs. House File 7 is about moving towards the kind of caring state we all want Minnesota to be, one that reflects the compassion Minnesotans have for our family, friends, and neighbors. And with that, I just urge committee support of House File 7. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Olson, and thank you to our testifier as well. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 7 be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chairbreaker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Herr, aye. Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Mortensen?
No.
Representative Novotny?
No.
Representative Farr?
No.
Representative Robbins?
No.
Representative Vang? Representative Vang. Representative Jean.
Aye.
And Representative Vang. Right. We have 9 ayes and 6 nays.
With 9 ayes and 6 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 7 is on its way to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Olson, for joining us in Judiciary this morning. With that, members, we're going to move on to the next bill. The next bill on the agenda is House File 416. It's a Representative Edelson bill. This is another one where we're going to focus on the things that are the jurisdiction of our committee, primarily in Section 6, Subdivision 11, and Section 10 relating to the courts. Welcome to the committee, Representative Edelson. I move that House File 416 be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. And Representative Edelson, please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it's good to see you and the rest of the members this morning. House File 416 is what we is known as the Juvenile Life Without Parole Bill, but there are two sections that apply to this committee. Just for a little background, though, so all but four states of the 50 have amended their statute. Madam Chair, can you see me? Everything else is frozen. Can you hear me?
I can hear and see you just fine.
Okay, perfect. Good. Thank you. So all but four of the states, and Minnesota is one of them, have amended their statutes, and Minnesota has not. So I have today with me Professor Perry Morarity, who will be able to speak to the bill. But two sections are before the committee today. It's Subdivision 11, which are lines 9.6 through 9.12. as well as, and that's the review by the Court of Appeals, as well as lines 11.9 to 11.15, and that's Section 10, and that's the administrative review. And Madam Chair, I'll actually go to my testifier now.
All right. I have Professor Morarity, if you could introduce yourself and then go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you very much, Chair Becker-Fenn, and thank you, Representative Edelson. My name is Perry Morarity. I'm an associate professor at the University of Minnesota Law School, where I teach criminal law, juvenile law, and co-direct our clinical program. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to address the committee this morning. HF, House File 416, amends specific provisions of Minnesota's Heinous Crimes Act and other related provisions of the criminal code for those who committed their offenses under the age of 18. I'll say a few words about what the bill does before turning to the specific provisions with the chair's permission. Minnesota's Heinous Crimes Act, as it currently exists, is unconstitutional. It has been for almost 9 years. It currently requires courts to sentence youth convicted of aggravated homicide to life in prison without the opportunity for release. It has been unconstitutional since 2012, when the U.S. Supreme Court decided a case called Miller versus Alabama. 28 states were required to amend their laws when Miller was decided in 2012. Minnesota is one of just four that has not. As we sit here today, there is no legislative authority in place governing the sentences of juveniles convicted of aggravated homicide in Minnesota. This has led to disparate charging and sentencing decisions and, candidly, widespread uncertainty across the state. House File 416 remedies this. It abolishes the sentence of life without release for children in Minnesota. It makes every person in the state who committed his or her offense under the age of 18 eligible for release after serving 15 years. It does not in any way guarantee release. It simply creates an opportunity for review, and I'll discuss that momentarily. It applies retroactively and to multiple sentences. And for purposes of this committee's review, it creates a juvenile review board to review the cases of those who are eligible and provides for appellate review of the review board's decisions. Turning to the two specific sections identified by the committee, Subdivision 11, which contemplates review of the juvenile review board's decisions by the Court of Appeals. First, to give the committee some context, there are currently 95 people in Minnesota serving sentences of 15 years or more for offenses they committed as juveniles. 28 have already served 15 years or more, so would be ostensibly eligible for immediate review under this provision, which compared to other states is actually a very small number. To put it in context, Maryland has a view that just has a law that just passed, and there are 500 people eligible for review immediately. Minnesota, as we have a longstanding tradition of doing, has been parsimonious in the application of extreme punishments, which is good. The bill establishes a review board with relevant representation and expertise to consider these cases and make decisions about eligibility for release. And like most states, and consistent with our Administrative Procedure Act, Chapter 14, the bill also provides oversight of the powers and duties delegated to the Judicial Review Board, I'm sorry, the Juvenile Review Board. The purpose of this oversight, in this case by the appellate court, is to increase public accountability, ensure a uniform minimum procedure, increase public access to the process and outcomes, increase public participation in the formulation of the rules promulgated by the Juvenile Review Board, and to increase fairness in the context of contested case proceedings like this one, and candidly, to simplify the process of judicial review of agency action. The Court of Appeals is the right entity to do this. Its purpose, its existence really is to conduct review and to provide oversight. It has expertise reviewing written records, which include written findings of fact and determinations of law. It has statewide representation. And the burden on the court will not be undue. 28 cases ostensibly could be eligible for review in the first couple of years, but we anticipate that will reduce dramatically in the years to come, and it will be more cyclical, down to a few cases each year. So I'll stop there with the chair's permission, and I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you.
All right, thank you, Professor, for your testimony today. We'll move to member discussion. Members, any questions for the testifier for Representative Edelson? Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Edelson. This has been in the works for a number of years. In fact, in 2017, there was a commission put together to look at this issue of the juveniles that were in the system that fell under this. I believe 7 of the 8 at that time, their sentences had already been redone and looked at. So we don't really have anybody left that falls under this, and the court rules are doing this. I understand why we're doing this, but I have a concern because that panel put together of a possible release after 25 years. That was the recommendation. I'm wondering if you can explain why you're going to 15 instead of the recommendation of the panel that was put together in the 2017 recommendation.
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm actually going to defer to the professor on this issue.
All right. Professor Moriarty.
Chair Becker-Fenn, Representative Johnson. I was actually a member of that panel. It's the Commission on Juvenile Sentencing for Heinous Acts. We convened. It was a bipartisan commission that included representation of the House of Representatives and the Senate, both parties. We did meet and make findings in 2017, but we did not make any recommendation about a term of years. The commission was put together to determine what criteria the legislature should look to in the event that it wished to retain the punishment of life without release for juveniles. But because the Minnesota County Attorneys Association came to the table during the process to say it supported abolition of the punishment, in fact, the commission's ultimate recommendations and findings were that there were criteria if the legislature wished to retain the punishment, but because it was unlikely, the commission recommended that if the punishment were abolished, the legislature make a determination about the proper term of years. It was the County Attorneys Association that then came forward and said in 2017 that it would settle on 25 years. And in fact, County Attorney Jim Backstrom testified to that. But that was the county attorney's recommendation then. A lot has happened since then. In fact, states as diverse as Missouri, Indiana, Wisconsin, West Virginia, Oregon, New Mexico, across the country are now looking at review after 15 years. And the reason for that is because there is a lot of evidence coming forward that juveniles sentenced to life without release in prison die in their 40s or early 50s on average. And recidivism rates are quite low. Cost savings is quite high. So we believe, and in discussions with the Minnesota County's Attorney Association now, that something between 15 and what they had proposed, and we are starting with 15, is the right time period. As to the eight individuals that you referenced before, in fact, they have not all been resentenced. I represent one of them, and we still have a resentencing proceeding coming up in May. And several of the others are serving sentences as long as 60 to life or 90 to life at this point. So we think that those should be made uniform, and we think this bill does that. Thank you.
A follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, members. We also had Representative Neal was on this on that panel as well, and we looked at it. And the recommendation was not just what the county attorney said, their advice. It was the recommendation of the committee. And seven of the eight, they've had their sentences redone in compliance with the court ruling. This bill is trying to get us, our current law, somewhat in line with the court ruling. This goes well beyond that. So I do have some problems with this. I'm gonna leave it at that. And just right now, I cannot support this because I believe it goes too far. I've seen what's going on with the gangs in Minneapolis and shootings. If you want to have some interesting reading or looking, just look up the Minneapolis Shot Spotter.
And Representative Johnson, I think we'll move on. We're trying to stick to the appellate review and the things within the jurisdiction of this committee. And that was a lot of mentions of Minneapolis, but we're going to move on to Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks to Representative Edelson for bringing this bill and for Professor Moriarty for being here today. I just had a concern about the consecutive part of this bill, and I have some thoughts about that, and I would love to be able to be involved in some of those discussions. So I'm going to support the bill today, but I hope we can continue to talk about that.
Any response, Representative Edelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Moeller. Of course, we would love your expertise on this. And Representative Johnson as well, if you have ideas or feedback to work offline, I would be interested to talk to you as well.
All right. Thank you, Representative Edelson. Any closing words, Representative Edelson?
No, just thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for considering this. I think it's an important piece of legislation, and thank you for your time.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 416 be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Martinson?
No.
Representative Novotny?
No.
Representative Farr?
No.
Representative Robbins?
No.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang?
Aye.
There are 10 ayes and 6 nays.
With that, the motion prevails, and House File 416 is on its way to Ways and Means. And Representative Vang, I am glad that we got your IT issues figured out so that you could vote this morning. With that, members, thank you, Representative Edelson, and thank you to your testifier. We'll move on to the next bill, which is a Representative Long bill, House File 922. We'll be focusing our committee discussion on Section 2 relating to the courts. Representative Long, would you like to move your bill to the General Register?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is my motion.
All right, your bill is now before us. Please tell us about House File 922.
Thank you so much. When kids come into contact with the criminal justice system, we should do all we can to provide a fair process and also to set them up for long-term success. This bill contains 4 overdue common sense updates to our juvenile justice system. Before us today is just one of those reforms, which is Section 2. Section 2 removes the requirement for open hearings in certain juvenile proceedings. We should protect privacy for juveniles whenever possible when they're going through the court process. We know there are real risks to having youth hearings be open to the public with potentially lifelong consequences that can follow. I want to thank Representative Novotny for his co-authorship and support of this bill. The bill passed out of the Public Safety Committee unanimously, and I'm hopeful it will earn broad support in this committee as well. And with that, I'm happy to turn it over to my testifier, Ms. Katrina Dexter from the Department of Corrections.
All right, Ms. Dexter, please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I do believe Deputy Commissioner Shanklin was planning on testifying briefly before me.
Got it. Deputy Commissioner Shanklin, please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Curtis Shanklin, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Corrections, where I oversee our Reintegration and Restorative Services Division. Thank you all for your time today. I'll make this as brief as possible because I want to make sure that we can get to Ms. Dexter's testimony too as well. When we talk about criminal justice reform or transformative change, it's important to note two elements which are vital to achieving either of those two aspirations. One being the usual elephant in the room, which is the racial and ethnic disparities that exist within the criminal justice system. Unfortunately, here in Minnesota, especially for our youth, we're not immune from that fact. Our Native American and American Indian kids who we arrest here in Minnesota and place in out-of-home placement are done at rates that place Minnesota near the top in the nation when we talk about desperate treatment. Our Black and African-American kids we arrest and place in secure detention after arrest are done so also at rates that place Minnesota near the top in the nation when we talk about desperate treatment. When we think about greater Minnesota and our kids who are dealing with chemical dependency and mental health issues, that we continue to inappropriately use secure detention, primarily because our law enforcement partners and members of the courtroom workroom do not have the resources needed to appropriately address the needs of those youth. The other thing that I think is vital to, again, achieving those aspirations is an intentional focus on our youth here in Minnesota, which is why we encourage not only members of the community, but justice stakeholders, when they think about those youth, to think about it through the My Child test. So essentially, if your daughter or son, granddaughter or grandson, niece or nephew made a poor choice or was with a group of youth who made a poor choice, how would you want their treatment and experience to be within the juvenile justice system? I'm being a little presumptuous, but I would guess that it would be to ensure first and foremost that their needs are met, that they are held appropriately accountable, but more importantly, that they don't have any further contact with the criminal justice system in its entirety. And by using the My Child test, we also begin to think about those kids as our kids. And when we begin to think about those kids as our kids, then I think that we're more inclined to work with a sense of urgency. I think we're more inclined to put in a little bit more work at the end of our day. And I think we are also more inclined to give a little bit more empathy, a little bit more grace, and a little bit more humanity when we're thinking about what are the best options and the best resources to fit the needs of our youth. Those kids in Minnesota deserve better because, in fact, those kids are our kids, and we can do better. It is imperative that we can do better, and we can also do that right now. The juvenile justice legislative platform that we put together provides us that opportunity, which is inclusive of the provision that is before this committee here today. It provides this body an opportunity to show Minnesotans that even in a divided legislature, we can come together across party lines and get work accomplished. More importantly, because the importance of our youth lives transcends party lines. And as Representative Long mentioned, I think that is illuminated with the bipartisan support from a number of members of this committee and before the previous committee that this bill did pass with unanimous support. And I think that is because members across both lines have decided that when it comes to our youth here in Minnesota, that it is important that we work together and that we can do that to achieve meaningful success that is done by way of effective legislation that will impact all youth here in Minnesota. And just to know, every day that goes by that we don't act with a sense of urgency, with a sense of determination, with a lot of intentionality, is a day, in fact, that we don't value those kids as our kids, that we essentially don't love those kids as we do our kids. is a day that we ultimately don't value, again, those kids as our kids. And just to put it frankly, as I said before, that is not one Minnesota. With that, I will conclude my testimony here today, Madam Chair, and be available for questions. And I'll pass it on to my colleague, Ms. Katrina Dexter, who's the director of our Juvenile Justice Reform Unit. Thank you.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner, for some good reminders there in that testimony. Next, we'll go to Ms. Dexter, if you could introduce yourself and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify regarding this important legislation. My name is Katrina Dexter, and I'm the Director of Juvenile Justice Reform at the Department of Corrections. Today, I'm here to testify on House File 922. And first and foremost, I want to thank the members, both Republican and Democrat, who have already signed on to author this bill. I want to frame my testimony in the understanding of what this bill and the provisions within were built upon. That is what we know is in best practice in juvenile justice, as well as extensive research we have on adolescent brain development. With that being said, I will transition into speaking to the current bill, including the provision which falls within the jurisdiction of this committee. And I'll keep my testimony limited, as I know you have a full agenda today. The bill before us now, as previously stated, is House File 922, which is co-authored by Representative Long and Representative Novotny. There are four sections or provisions to the bill, which include ending indiscriminate use of restraints in juvenile court, closing juvenile court proceedings, providing explicit statutory authority for our local law enforcement to divert youth into programming, and requiring our secure detention facilities in Minnesota to implement a risk assessment tool at the point of intake. The second section of this bill is regarding public hearings for 16 or 17-year-olds and will be the focus of my testimony here today. Currently, if a youth is 16 or 17 years old and has been alleged to have committed a felony-level offense, their court hearings are open to the public. This provision would close those court hearings. However, we have carved out an exception for cases classified under extended jurisdiction juvenile or EJJ status. It is important as we make advancements in technology that we understand the potential collateral consequences that may come from those advancements. As an example, if a youth's court hearing is open to the public, a local reporter could attend that court hearing, publish the details of the case, including the juvenile or the youth's name in the local newspaper. Subsequently, that case could be dismissed, or maybe the youth is never found guilty. Unfortunately, the name of the juvenile may live on forever on the internet in that local newspaper article, and is only a Google search away. This section attempts to limit those collateral consequences that may come with that. This concludes my testimony on House File 922, Madam Chair, and I will be available for questions as well. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. With that, we will move to member discussion and questions. Any questions, members? Representative Johnson.
Chair Rebecca Finn, members. This bill I support. I have no problems with this bill. It does good things. I'm just very disappointed in the testimony I heard. Law enforcement, when they do detain children or remove them from a home, they don't do it willy-nilly. They have to do it. There's a procedure in place. When they commit a crime, they don't always go to due to a detention facility. They look at the circumstances. They look at what the crime was, how the child reacts, how the parents react. If we can get a child back in their home, that is what we want. Law enforcement, and especially the sheriff's departments, do not want to detain in a detention facility. If they can avoid going into the child placement at all, they avoid it. It's expensive. It's hard on budgets. When a juvenile is placed in a juvenile detention facility, it's cost even more than just into a foster care system, which is also expensive as well. I myself have arrested many juveniles. I would say 99% of them went back home. And we worked with the parents to make sure, because generally the problem wasn't at home, it was somewhere else. And the parents are usually pretty good. Once in a while, you have that parent that refuses So you're between a rock and a hard place. But law enforcement doesn't intentionally go to remove children if they commit crimes unless they have to.
Representative Johns, I'll just remind you that we're focused on Section 2 regarding the court procedures.
I understand that, but I'm correcting the testimony of a testifier that gave bad information in a bad light, and I've had enough of it. Law enforcement does their best to get those kids at home. Social workers do their best to get the kids back at home. That is their goal, and that is their mission. We also, law enforcement also wants to protect the citizens of the communities they live. They do not want to put these kids into juvenile detention facilities, but sometimes there's no choice. If you have a kid doing drive-by shootings, you have kids shooting at people, violently attacking them, can we have them out on the streets? No. But we do our best not to put them there on nonviolent crimes. But there again, we actually work with the parents for proper placement, and our goal is to have them at home whenever possible. Thank you.
Quick follow-up, Deputy Commissioner Shanklin. We've got a lot of bills today, but and if we could stick to the Section 2 regarding the courts as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Representative Johnson, I just wanted to just make sure that there was just clarity. I absolutely agree with everything that you mentioned. I hope no one insinuated that local law enforcement is not doing their best to work on behalf of our youth. Part of my testimony was simply just pointing out that more often than not, they don't have the resources that they need to find the appropriate settings for those youth, and that we continue to need to invest in our local law enforcement partners to make sure that they have the resources that they need. So just wanted to make sure that was clarified, but I do take everything that you said, Representative Johnson, into account. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Seeing no other hands raised, Representative Long, any closing words?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hope members can support the bill.
All right. Thank you very much. Representative Long renews his motion that House File 922 be recommended to be placed on the general register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Beckerfin.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist. Representative Feist. Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel. Excused. Representative Hur.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
Aye.
Representative Novotny.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
And Representative Feist. There's 15 ayes and no nays.
All right, the motion prevails and House File 922 is on its way to the general register. We're gonna keep it moving, members. Thank you everyone for doing your best to stay focused on the things before our committee. House File 306 is a Representative Frazier bill that is next on our agenda. Representative Frazier, would you like to move your bill be recommended to be referred to Ways and Means?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would like to make that motion.
All right, your bill is now before us. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am very happy and proud to be carrying House File 306. Currently, the state requires that the courts charge a $75 state surcharge fee that is added to every trafficking criminal citation. The problem with that is oftentimes it has a disproportionate impact on our poor folks that are going through the criminal justice system, and it causes issues that will also be highlighted in the next bill on license suspending. What this bill will do is allow for courts to actually, or the judge to have discretion on how to apply that or charge that $75 surcharge. It will also require that there is a notification put on the citation to allow individuals to know that they have to, that they can ask the judge for that discretion, and it will require the judge to take into account whether or not the individual can actually pay the $75 surcharge. I do have testifiers here today to discuss this bill and individuals that are practicing in our criminal justice system from the defense side and the prosecution side to talk about the impact that this current required surcharge has on the criminal justice system and the individuals that they serve. I also have Anna Odegaard here to testify as well. And I want to say that I really am proud to carry this bill because it's been a long time coming, and it's been a huge coalition that's worked on this bill. And I'd like to thank my colleagues on the opposite side of the aisle for joining in as well. It's really been a bipartisan bill, and I'm happy to carry the bill today. And I'd like to turn it over to Anna Odegaard to provide more information.
All right. We'll go to Ms. Odegaard first. I will note there are a lot of similarities in the goals that are trying to be accomplished between this bill and my bill, House File 336, which we have up next. So if the testifiers would prefer to speak generally to both bills, I think that would be appropriate, especially in the interest of time. So Ms. Odegaard, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Much, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify. My name is Anna Odegaard, and I'm the legislative advocate for the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition. I'd like to just start by thanking Chair Becker Finn and Representative Frazier for recognizing how fines and fees disproportionately burden low-income individuals, especially in communities of color, and to really thank them for their leadership on the fines and fees reform bills we are hearing this morning. I'd also just like to thank the co-authors on this committee who have signed on and supported these bills, including Representative Feist, Representative Herr, Representative Hollins, and Representative Long. Thank you so much. As Representative Frazier let you know, House File 306 gives judges discretion to reduce, waive, or offer community service in lieu of the $75 state surcharge. The surcharge is tacked on top of every criminal and traffic violation, and it's what bumps your basic traffic ticket up over $100. It is a revenue raiser for the state. The revenue from the surcharge goes directly into the general fund. Under existing Minnesota statute, judges have discretion over most fines and fees, including the underlying traffic or criminal fine. But judges are required to impose the full $75 state surcharge on every violation, even in cases of financial hardship. This bill would give judges the same discretion over that state surcharge that they have over the underlying traffic or criminal fine. And as Representative Frazier said, it also requires judges to consider a person's ability to pay before imposing that sentence. It doesn't infringe on their discretion to impose the fines and fees they think are appropriate, but it requires them to consider ability to pay as one of the factors before they impose that sentence. I want to just point out one last thing, that this reform is directly in line with the American Bar Association's 2018 guidelines on court fines and fees, which state, and it's just two sentences, I'm not going to read you a whole page. If a state or local legislature or a court imposes fees in connection with a conviction for a criminal offense or civil infraction, the amount imposed should never be greater than an individual's ability to pay. No law or rule should limit or prohibit a judge's ability to waive or reduce any fee, and a waiver of fees should be accessible for people for whom payment would cause a substantial hardship. So that essentially defines exactly what this bill would do. This bill is supported by a broad coalition of stakeholders, including city attorneys and public defenders and many community organizations. The coalition I work for, the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition, supports this bill because our member organizations work every day with families who are struggling financially and for whom that $75 state surcharge is truly a burden. This bill empowers the court to right-size fines and fees to a person's ability to pay rather than imposing fines and fees that force people to choose between paying court debt and meeting the basic needs of their family. Thank you so much to our bill authors and for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Odegaard. We've got two other testifiers on the list, so we'll finish up the testimony before we get to member discussion. Next on the list is Dave Hunt. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and good morning, members of the committee. It's my great privilege to be here to testify this morning. I'm a prosecutor with the St. Paul City Attorney's Office. I've been a criminal prosecutor for almost 30 years. And I support these bills, as does my office. I've worked in the criminal justice system since about 1990, and I've prosecuted thousands of cases anything from felony assaults, murders, to traffic offenses, including the type of offenses, traffic offenses that these two bills are aimed at. And it's my opinion that passing this legislation will be a move towards justice and fairness. I've seen hundreds of, and maybe thousands of cases of drivers that get caught up in this cycle, this revolving door of committing a petty misdemeanor traffic offense, such as speeding or a stop sign violation, and then not paying the fines and fees associated with that, and then having their license suspended. Sometimes the drivers don't even know that their license has been suspended for failure to pay or appear. Other times, and this is quite often, I've seen people that just don't have the money to pay for several traffic tickets. Maybe they've got two or three tickets going on at the same time, and they just can't come up with the fines and the fees. The costs associated with the tickets just compound and get bigger and bigger. Their license, driver's licenses get suspended, and then suddenly they've got no way to go get to work. They don't have a way to pick up their kids from school. They can't get the doctor's appointments. They can't come to court to address the cases. And so it's kind of a vicious cycle. And I think that passing this legislation will take these folks out of that revolving door. Both of the bills are not free passes either. And I want to just clarify that. As a prosecutor, I still have tools that I can use, particularly to prosecute and address scofflaw and repeat offenders. And I think that the bills forgive some of the fines and the fees, and they allow to reinstate drivers that have had their driving privileges suspended for minor traffic offenses. But it's not a get out of jail free or a free pass. I can still prosecute people that repeatedly violate and get their licenses suspended. There are still statutes that allow me to do that. These bills don't forgive the fines and fees for serious traffic offenses too. I want to clarify that. DWIs, reckless driving, criminal vehicular operation, anything that's a misdemeanor level offense or higher, I can still prosecute, and we're not going to forgive the fines and fees for those people under this legislation. The legislation really is addressed towards the petty misdemeanor driving offender that has traffic tickets for speeding or, like I said, a stop sign violation. The criminal justice system is just hugely burdened right now. My office prosecutes 11,000 criminal cases per year. We want to focus our resources on the really serious ones, the domestic assault cases, DWI cases, illegal firearm cases, the ones that really endanger people, and those are the cases that really need, I think, our resources. It's not just my office that's burdened by the hundreds and thousands of petty misdemeanor driving offenses and suspensions related to those fees and fines, but the judges are burdened by that. And the public defender's office is extremely burdened by that. We'd all like to focus on what we think is the most important. And in my opinion, it's the more serious things like DWIs in domestic violence. So I'm asking for your support on both of these bills. My office supports both of these bills. And I'm happy to take questions later on if needed, but thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list is Joelle Sather. If you could introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for this opportunity, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Joelle Sather, and I'm an assistant Hennepin County public defender. I have been a Hennepin County public defender for over 25 years. In order to qualify for the services of a public defender, a client must make no more than $19,320 per year as a single person. My clients are often employed as landscapers, wait staff, janitors, or gas station attendants. With the additional cost of rental housing, the economic strain felt by my clients on an everyday basis is very real. I spent about 7 years handling only misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor cases, the majority of them being driving cases. For each of these cases, there was a fine, a late charge, court fees and assessments, a reinstatement fee, and potentially a public defender surcharge for each ticket. the total amount owed often exceeded $800 per ticket. So when I look collectively at my clients' tickets and the corresponding police reports, there are some common trends that I see. It's common to find multiple tickets issued around the same time of day on the same stretch of road issued by the same police officers. The clients stopped are almost always people of color, and the stops are initiated because the police officers ran the plates of the car as opposed to observing some driving conduct. And I think most importantly for me with regard to this is the underlying knowledge that the current laws adversely affect the poor and people of color. Prior to passing the bar, I would have been eligible for the services of a public defender. I know that when my clients tell me they can't afford a $75 surcharge, that they are telling the truth. When they make around $10 an hour, sometimes they have kids to care for, they drive older cars that tend to break down, and they live in areas that aren't near their jobs, paying $75 on top of a fine really is insurmountable. So I wholly support giving judges the ability to waive or reduce the $75 surcharge or to offer them the opportunity to complete community service to satisfy that surcharge. Many of my clients ask me now, can they please work it off with community service because they just can't pay it as they are already struggling to meet the basic needs on their income. I also support the requiring the judges to assess the ability to pay before imposing fines and fees. Now, currently, many of the judges I go before of already do this, but it's important that we make sure that every judge asks about a person's ability to pay. And while I represent the poor, there are varying levels of the poor, and it seems fair and just to take that into consideration. And for that reason, I really thank you for this opportunity, and I hope that you will support House File 306. In addition, I can address 336 if you'd like. Okay, just to go on a little bit more about that one, I think it is unclear how easy it is to get caught up in that system of suspension and resuspension. Many of my clients can tell a story of how they first found out they were suspended. And it usually did start by forgetting about or not paying a simple moving violation like speeding. They don't realize it until they're pulled over. And the officer says, hey, your license is suspended. And they're like, I didn't know. And then they give them a ticket for driving after suspension on top of the underlying speeding charge. So now they either pay both tickets or they go to see a hearing officer to try to get a deal. And the hearing officer may say, I can lower the fine. And so the clients think, great, I'll pay the lower fine. And they pay them both and they walk out the door. And they leave there thinking, okay, I took care of everything and I can go back to driving legally. When all of a sudden they get stopped again and the officer says, hey, your license is suspended. And they're like, what? I took care of this. Confused, they go back to the hearing officer who may or may not explain that paying the ticket is what caused an additional suspension. And that's how it begins. These tickets start a cycle of indebtedness to the state that puts them in the challenging position of choosing between breaking the law to travel to and from work or to not work and not make rent or pay or feed their families. It is not likely that these were the outcomes that were intended by the statutes, and as such, they should be changed. I think the effects of the laws and the way that they are enforced, they prevent my clients from moving out of poverty by stacking up the fines they owe to the state. I spend an extraordinary amount of time and effort working with my clients to get them out of this cycle. The changes proposed here would make great strides in creating equitable treatment of minor traffic offenses. I hope you will support House File 336 additionally and allow people to continue to drive illegally while they pay off their court debt. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you for your testimony. With that, we will move to member discussion. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is for the author. This bill originally sponsored in the last session by my predecessor, Representative Zerwas. My question or my comment is, why don't we go farther? Why don't we eliminate the surcharge overall? Then we don't have to come back in 2 years and adjust it for, adjust it for inflation or anything like that. The bill was originally put in for one purpose, and that was to balance a budget deficit. That's why we have these surcharges. It doesn't go to a specific fund. It's not helping traffic safety. It's not for extra enforcement or anything like that. So that would be my question to Representative Fraser. Why don't we just overall drop it? Would you accept an amendment if this comes back to public safety to do that?
Representative Fraser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Vodney, thank you for raising that issue. I would be open to, if we can eliminate these fees totally, so that we're not having this burden, so that we don't have to continue to come back. I would see that as progress. So I would absolutely be open to that amendment.
Representative Novotny and I will note that we would have to probably fill that budget hole with something else. But any follow-up, Representative Novotny?
I will have that amendment drafted. Thank you.
Thank you. Next on the list is Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Fraser, I want to thank you again for this bill. I love it. The problem is it doesn't go far enough. I would like to see all the surcharges and fees on all petty misdemeanors removed. They started back in the late 80s and early 90s during budget deficits to fund the courts. We have a constitutional responsibility to do that. It should not be on the backs of especially anybody other than the shouldn't be on the backs of the people that actually get a citation. It should be the backs of every citizen of the state, because it is our constitutional responsibility. Just like I said, it started in the late 80s, early 90s, then the mid 2000s during that deficit, they were increased. And in 2014, a technology fee was also added. I think it was $10 onto the surcharges. So right now, in most jurisdictions, a $25 maximum fine for a seatbelt ticket is, I believe, $135 to $140, with just $25 being the actual fine. So I'm in favor of removing all of these. I know it's a huge fiscal note that Chair Becker-Finn would have to deal with. I would love to do it, at least for now, just get it done on the petty misdemeanors, because that's where the problem starts, is the petty misdemeanor offenses. The speeding, not the excessive speeding where you're endangering people, but doing 66 in a 55 or 37 in a 30. I'm torn on stop signs because I think there's another bill dealing with if you're in an accident, run a stop sign, and you're involved in an accident, it bumps it up, and people get injured, it bumps it up to a misdemeanor. But like those just regular petty misdemeanor offenses, if we can eliminate those, we're going to eliminate a lot of problems, and we probably won't even have to deal with the next bill that's coming up, because those issues would be taken care of. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. I will note that I am told that eliminating the surcharge would cost $31 million. So if members are open to raising that revenue in other ways, obviously we would be open to that. And a good lesson about thinking further down the road about how we fund our state and who is paying and who is not. With that, I do not see any other hands raised. So Representative Fraser, any closing words on your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. I appreciate the comments from my colleagues about eliminating all these fines. And for me, it really touches base, because we understand the burden, who this burden falls upon. And it's our poor and disproportionately poor and our BIPOC community folks that the burden is falling upon. Anytime we can try to eliminate those type of disparities, I'm all on board. But I am very well aware of the cost that it would be to do that. So I'm looking forward to having a conversation and seeing how we could work that out. But other than that, I would encourage everyone to support this bill.
All right. Thank you, Representative Fraser. Representative Fraser renews his motion that House File 306 be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Frazier?
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Hurd? Representative Hurd? Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Mortensen?
Aye.
Representative Novotny?
Aye.
Representative Farr?
Aye.
Representative Robbins?
Aye.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang?
Aye.
And Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Perfect. There are 16 ayes and no nays.
All right, with that, the motion prevails and House File 306 is on its way to Ways and Means. I will now pass the virtual gavel to Vice Chair Mueller as the next bill up is House File 336, which is my bill. So, Vice Chair Mueller, you're the chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as you just said, the next bill is House File 336 related to driver's license suspension waivers, which we just heard a little bit about already with the testimony. Chair Becker-Finn, would you like to move your bill?
So moved, Madam Chair. I will move that House File 336 be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. And I will note that one of my testifiers didn't make it on the agenda, and that is Jason Flores. So when we get to testimony, just want to make sure that we have that taken care of. And Madam Chair, in the interest of time, I'm just going to start talking about my bill now that it's before us. So House File 336, as mentioned by some of the testifiers, is really a partner bill, a sister bill to Representative Frazier's bill. And this House File 336 specifically has to do with the practice of suspending driver's licenses for reasons that are not related to public safety, specifically the failure to pay fines or the failure to appear in court. And ultimately, as noted, if we want people to pay the fines, which is ultimately, I think, if we're going to have fines, we want people to pay them. Making it illegal for those folks to drive to work is it doesn't accomplish anything. It's purely punitive, and it's actually counterproductive in keeping people functioning and doing well. And as noted in the closing words by Representative Frazier, this disproportionately impacts folks who don't have the means to pay those fines right up front. And as well as folks who, you know, may, you know, their housing may not be as stable. It may be harder to communicate about, you know, when those court hearings are or anything like that. And as I noted, it's this just these purely punitive practices just pushed people deeper into the criminal justice system, where something that started as a simple, you know, traffic ticket that they didn't, you know, have the means to pay initially. Now, all of a sudden, you're driving with a suspended license, and this initial, misbehavior ends up impacting the entire public safety process and takes up a lot of time and a lot of resources in addition to further pushing that individual further into the criminal justice system in a way that doesn't really benefit anybody. And so with that, as I noted, most of the testifiers for Representative Frazier's bill, very similar reasoning behind this bill, but I would pass it to Jason Flores with the chair's permission to provide some additional testimony.
Okay, Mr. Flores, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and you can begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jason Flores. I'm the State Director for Americans for Prosperity Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today in support of these important reforms. Three quick points I want to share about this bill. First, the suspension of a driver's license, as we've heard, often triggers a cascading set of unintended difficulties for an individual and their family. It's an additional burden imposed by the state that actually makes it harder to get those original debts paid. Second, we believe that law enforcement resources should go toward ensuring public safety, not toward debt collection. The personnel time alone needed to process each traffic stop related to suspended licenses adds up to more than $10 million in costs to Minnesota taxpayers for the time spent detaining, questioning, and processing those individuals who may not pose any risk to public safety. Third, while this reform aims to prevent some of those collateral consequences, it doesn't let offenders off the hook. Minnesota has alternatives in place to ensure accountability, including collections proceedings, garnishments, liens, revenue recapture. And it's also important that this bill only deals with the unpaid debts. It does not change suspensions of licenses under Minnesota's habitual violator law or for any dangerous or negligent driving, including mandatory suspensions for DUI. Dangerous and unsafe drivers will still be held to account, but suspensions will be tied to driving behavior and actual threats to public safety, not to someone's ability to pay. Madam Chair, thank you so much for the time today. Appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Thank you, Mr. Flores. And Chair Beckerfin, did you have any other testifiers that you wanted to call forward now?
I think Anna Odegaard may have just a couple words of additional testimony in addition to what she shared earlier.
Okay, great. Welcome back, Ms. Odegaard. Please introduce yourself one more time and begin.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify on House File 336. I actually had not planned to testify again, but as long as you've called me, I will just call your attention to the broad support for this bill. I believe in your committee packets, there is a letter from the Minnesota Catholic Conference, which is supporting this reform, a letter from the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, which has said they published an op-ed last year explaining that driver's license suspensions for unpaid traffic tickets has not worked as an enforcement mechanism, and therefore they are supporting this bill as well. And then most recently, really pleased that the Minnesota State Bar Association vetted this bill and decided to support it as well. I think there's a letter from them as well in your committee packets. And then, you know, as I've been working on these bills with the coalition, you know, we're working with faith-based organizations, racial justice organizations, Coalition for the Homeless that recognizes that these license suspensions, as Jason pointed out, lead to this cascade of financial impacts that often even bring people further into poverty. And those are for folks who are having trouble paying a traffic ticket in the first place. So just want to point to the broad support, thank our authors. Again, I just really appreciate, we've had some really fantastic legislative champions from both sides of the aisle on this bill. And I'm just really appreciative that that you recognize this impact that these license suspensions have on individuals and families. And thank you so much for your support.
Thank you, Ms. Odegaard. And do we have any questions or comments from members? All right, not seeing any. Chair Beckerfin, did you have any final comments?
Just appreciate the support. This is our third committee stop, so I think a lot of members have asked some questions along the way, and really appreciate that this is not a partisan issue and is about what's doing, you know, really focused on helping folks who are most in need of our support and making sure that they're not disproportionately carrying the burden of paying for our system. So it's a great bill and appreciate member support. And I will just in case, since you have the gavel, we're not going to adjourn, we're going to recess. So with that, I will renew my motion that House File 336 be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
All right, Chair Beckerfin has renewed her motion, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Beckerfin.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Hurt.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
Aye.
Representative Watney.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
And Representative Zhang.
Aye.
Perfect. So there are 15 ayes and one nay.
Okay, with 15 ayes and one nay, the motion prevails, and House File 336 is recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Chair Beckerfin, I believe you wanted the gavel back, so turning it back over.
All right, thank you, Vice Chair Mueller, wanting to make the best use of our remaining 7 minutes. So I'm going to go ahead and move 1436, and I'm sorry, staff, that I didn't give you a bigger heads up that I was going to do that, but didn't know how quickly we would move today. So we're going to move House File 1436, which is a Representative Hansen bill, Hansen J. And I believe she is here. So I will go ahead and move that House File 1436 be recommended to be re-referred to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. Representative Hansen, we have your bill in front of us. Please tell us about your bill, remembering that we have 6 minutes, and I would love for your testifier to be able to get their testimony on the record before we hit 10 o'clock. So Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. This will be a fast bill, so I'm going to go really quickly through this. You were sent information from DHS with more details about this, but I'll provide an overview of this agency bill for the committee. And though there are no testifiers planned for this bill today, I can always follow up with DHS to make sure we get any questions answered. And I'd also just like to take a second to thank Senators Hoffman, Etke, and Abler for carrying this companion bill in the Senate. HF 1436 contains two provisions. The first piece of this bill ensures appeals related to child support good cause exemptions occur in a timely manner and does not require parents to choose between their safety and their ability to continue to receive the state assistance that they need to support themselves and their children. People should not be put in a position to choose to lose their benefits they need because of a safety concern presented within the child support system. If someone believes there is a safety risk to themselves or their children, this allows them to opt out of child support services. It is a federal requirement to have this opt-out option available, and this bill moves the state-level appeal to begin before the family's benefits, like MFIP, for example, are sanctioned. If a county denies a good cause request, this authorizes an appeal to the Department of Human Services to be done within 30 calendar days after a county denies a request for good cause to cooperate with child support. This puts all child support enforcement efforts on hold until DHS issues a decision. It also clarifies that the public authority for child support may issue a notice of noncompliance, either one, when 30 calendar days have passed since county denial, or the state agency denial, whichever is later. And two, the individual has not cooperated as required in 256.741 in subdivision 5. The second piece of this bill authorizes Minnesota courts to transfer court cases involving child support to tribal courts when tribal 40 agencies provide services on the case, allowing district courts to transfer child support cases to tribal courts when certain requirements are met, prevents tribal families from the burden of complying with an unnecessarily complicated process in multiple court systems when seeking to modify child support. Essentially, this stops families from having to go to court in two places when district and tribal courts are engaged. This is not a new bill. This portion has been passed by the House twice in the last few sessions. And with that, Madam Chair, I will turn it over for questions. And that is my presentation.
All right, Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Hansen, thank you for bringing this forward. I have worked with the tribal nations with these issues in the past. In fact, I know how well it works, and it works well. Between the people that deal with this understand the complications between the federal and state rules dealing with especially the indigenous people. And I think it's a good idea to do that. In my own family, I have a relative that is of indigenous descent, and working with the tribes and everybody, the child was placed not in the indigenous family, but the other side of the family as the best interest of the child. So I know how well the system works, and it works well. And I'm sure that these putting this in there is going to actually help things work. So thank you.
All right, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to Representative Hansen for bringing this bill. And I do just have a quick question, if you might know the answer. How often are these good cause denials requested, and how often are they granted versus denied, if you know of any data at all? Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you. Representative Scott, I do not have the data available, but I would be happy to follow up with DHS to see if they have that information available, and would certainly be happy to send it to you and the other committee members as well.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I encourage members to support this bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Hansen, any quick closing words in our remaining 2 minutes this morning?
Nope, I'll give you your time back and time to vote. And I just want to thank the committee members and thank you for giving me an opportunity to present this today. This is important in making sure that we're honoring the dignity and worth of families that are going through these systems, and I really appreciate it. So thank you.
Yep, I will renew my motion that House File 1436 be recommended to be re-referred to Human Services, Finance, and Policy. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn. Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Hearn.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
Aye.
Representative Novotny.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Fang.
Aye.
Representative Sean.
Aye.
There are 16 ayes and no nays.
The motion prevails, and House File 1436 is recommended to be re-referred to Human Services, Finance, and Policy. With that, members, we will recess and come back at 5 o'clock to finish up what's on our agenda today. We stand in recess. All right, I call us to order. We are reconvening the March 9th Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Welcome, members, and thank you, everybody, for getting through a bunch of bills this morning. We've got three more this evening, and gonna also try to catch some daylight still today. So we will get right to it. First up, we have a bill from Representative Frederick. It is House File 1432. The committee, it is here before us in this committee regarding Section 7, which is relating to data. So we're gonna keep our focus and our discussion to that section. Welcome to the committee, Representative Frederick. I will move that House File 1432 be recommended to be placed on a general register. I understand that you have an author's amendment, Representative Frederick, is that correct?
It is.
Okay, I will move the A21-0075 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author desires. Any discussion to the amendment? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Thank you, members other than Representative Feist, for voting. So the bill, as amended, is now before us. Representative Frederick, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. So the Vulnerable Adult Act was created our county-based adult protection system in Minnesota about 40 years ago. Similar to the child protection, adult protection teams respond to reports of abuse, neglect, or financial exploitation against vulnerable adults who live in the community, not in long-term care facilities. Unfortunately, in many of these cases, the perpetrators are family members and loved ones, including adult children, grandchildren, trusted caregivers, and other relatives. A lot has changed in the field of practice over 40 years, and although the Vulnerable Adult Act has gone through several changes, DHS is leading a redesign to update and modernize the law. County adult protection units have a dual role. They both, one, provide social services to vulnerable adults, and two, investigate claims of maltreatment to help keep the vulnerable adults safe. These investigations sometimes aid law enforcement if criminal conduct is uncovered. This bill is before your committee because DHS is proposing some changes to data classification and data sharing in the Vulnerable Adult Act. Currently, the law does not account for the two distinct roles, social service provider and investigator, and treats all data collected by adult protection service as private data. And this is problematic because data related to the investigation should be a higher classification as confidential data, similar to that in child protection investigations. Since investigative data in the welfare system is already confidential per Chapter 13, the changes in Section 7 of this bill makes it a simple yet important fix. This fix aligns the classification of investigative data of county maltreatment investigations with the classification of other investigative data in current law. This change will provide much needed clarity and will make it much easier for counties to protect the maltreatment investigation process until findings can be made and the investigation is completed. At this point, I would like to turn it over to DHS with your permission, Madam Chair.
Right. Thank you, Representative Frederick. I'm not sure who from DHS was planning to testify, so if you want to just introduce yourself for the record and please go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, Dan Pollack, Assistant Commissioner for Continuing Care for Older Adults at DHS. Really appreciate the committee's time. I don't have a lot to add other than to say that we really do see a significant need for this, and especially coming out of the pandemic and COVID, people who live in the community and are vulnerable adults need a vulnerable adult system, an adult protection system that is a little bit more functional and is a little bit more of a 21st century approach. And so we think that this begins to address some of the needs of it, of the system. And in particular, I think this reflects a really broad-based stakeholder engagement process that has talked to counties, has talked to law enforcement, has talked to people on the ground that are really on the front lines of adult protection and gotten their ideas for improvement and begins to make progress in that direction. So I'm happy to take questions, or I can defer to the committee.
All right, thank you, Assistant Commissioner. Looks like we do have some member questions. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the bill's author, are there any entities that are opposed to this new language? I know stakeholders have been meeting regarding kind of reforming this area of law. So I'm just wondering if there are any stakeholders that are not okay with this.
Okay. Representative Frederick.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, that's an excellent question. Everyone that I've talked to has been supportive of the language. I know DHS, and I will give credit where credit is due, has done massive bulk of heavy lifting on this. And that they have reached out to countless people, and there is no one that I'm aware of that is currently opposing the language change.
Any follow-up, Representative Scott?
No, thank you.
All right, thank you. Any further member discussion to the bill? All right, seeing none, we will give you the last word, Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's a lot going on here. It's an incredibly impactful thing when we're talking about the Vulnerable Adult Act. It is a very important piece of legislation, and I was hesitant to take it on because I knew how big of a deal it is. And so I think to Representative Scott and the question of like, what other feedback are we getting? I think that DHS has done a fantastic job of reaching out to just lots and lots and lots and lots of stakeholders. And I want to give a shout out to Nicole Stockert from DHS for doing a lot of the work there. She's fantastic to work with and done great work with this bill. So thank you for hearing it, and thank you to members.
All right. Thank you, Representative Frederick. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1432, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling, excused. Representative Long. Representative Long. Representative Mortensen.
Aye.
Representative Devotny.
Devotny, aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Vane.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
And Representative Lung.
Aye.
There's 15 ayes and no nays.
All right, the motion prevails and the bill is on its way to the general register. Thank you, Representative Frederick, and hope it wasn't too bad for your first time in the Judiciary Committee. With that, we'll get moving right on to the next bill. The next bill on our agenda is House File 1287. This is a Representative Hollins bill. Representative Hollins, would you like to move your bill to be recommended to be re-referred to the Human Services Policy and Finance Committee?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that is my motion.
All right, great. We have the bill before us, and it's my understanding you also have an author's amendment. Would you like to move the A2 author's amendment?
Yes, please. I would like to move the author's amendment.
All right. The A2 amendment is in front of us to get the bill in the shape that the author would like. Any discussion to the amendment? All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Hollins, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members, for hearing this important bill. So the main purposes of this bill are to bring Minnesota's foster care licensing standards more in line with our adoption standards, to remove unnecessary barriers that exist in current law for relatives in communities of color seeking foster care licenses, and to ensure the well-being and stability of children. Under our current law, our foster care licensing standards and processes make create many more barriers for individuals, including relatives, than even our adoption standards. This inconsistency creates problems for placing children in permanent safe homes, and it isn't good for family preservation or child well-being. This bill also brings Minnesota in line with current federal policy and recommendations relating to foster care licensing and background checks. It's really time for Minnesota to rethink the way that we license foster care providers. Unlike other providers requiring a DHS license, family foster homes are not a business, and they should be a safe haven for children who can't live at home. For communities of color, the statutory barriers in our current foster care licensing statute have an even greater impact, and this law would help remedy that disparity. When children can remain with relatives in foster care and stay connected to their families, they have better long-term outcomes, including higher high school graduation rates, decreased risk of mental health disorders, and less overall trauma. This bill is especially important because COVID-19 has made family visitation for children within the child welfare system really difficult. Increasing access for relatives to obtain foster care licenses during this time will make it easier for children to both remain close with family, but also see family more often and consistently while they're in the system and out of their homes. Finally, I'd like to say that this bill is supported by many constituents across a breadth of experience and perspectives. It provides a really well thought out and very well negotiated balance to ensure the safety of children and also a more reasonable list of barriers that don't exclude many wonderful foster care providers who have an imperfect past. And I do have two testifiers here with me today.
All right, we do have another amendment that's filed, but we're gonna get to the testifiers first and then we'll discuss that amendment. So first on the list, I have Alexis Oberdorfer, if you could unmute yourself and introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn and members of the committee. My name is Alexis Oberdorfer and I'm the president of Children's Home Society of Minnesota and I'm the associate vice president for Lutheran Social Service. I represent two of the longest standing foster care and adoption programs in Minnesota and we both date back to the late 1800s. I personally have over 25 years of professional experience in child welfare, and in a given year, my adoption team is involved in over 200 foster care and adoption placements throughout the state. Regardless of which door a family enters, there should be parity in the criteria that's used for foster care and adoption background studies. In 2018, we partnered with a local metropolitan county to assist kinship caregivers that needed to be licensed. And we had took a look at kin that were identified to have a relationship with the child, a Black child in particular, who had entered foster care. In that year, we served over 34 families, but approximately 25% of them needed licensing variances. We witnessed how the foster care licensing criteria can create barriers for the BIPOC community. And when we looked at this and kind of recalling some of the cases that we looked at, there were two that stood out to me. So the first, I'm just gonna call her Aunt Abby. She had a background study charge that popped up from 15 years earlier based off of a check fraud for which she had paid restitution. We supported her in seeking a licensing variance that was granted. She became licensed. She was an amazing resource for her niece and her nephew. And she really provided continuity to her family and mitigated trauma that these children could have experienced if they were cared for by somebody else who was not a family member or not familiar to them. They were reunified ultimately with their father. The second case is Grandma Joy, and she had lost her daughter right before we worked with her to an opioid overdose. She was dealing with significant grief and loss at the time. She wanted to care for her 5-year-old granddaughter, but she endured a series of obstacles to become foster care licensed. One of the barriers that she encountered was the background check process, and that she had a 12-year-old charge from economic assistance fraud that had nothing to do with her ability to care for her granddaughter. Again, we sought a variance. We were successful at achieving that. Grandma Joy became licensed in fall of 2018, and then she did go on to adopt her granddaughter in the spring of 2019. When I sit and talk with my management team about non-relative foster care and adoptive families that we serve, they would tell me that less than 5% of our clients typically seek variances, and it really does demonstrate the disparities that are faced by BIPOC communities. We also know that research about relative and kinship caregivers demonstrate that they are some of the most stable placements and promote resilience for kids when they can be cared for in a setting with somebody that's very familiar with them. So based on all of this information and what our experiences are, I would testify on behalf and support of this bill, and I would urge this to be passed in this committee, and I thank you for your time today.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list is Max Page from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony. Oh, Max, you're muted. You were unmuted, but we still couldn't hear you.
Can you hear me now, Chair Beckerfin?
Yes, I can. Please introduce yourself and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin, and good evening, committee members. My name is Max Page, and I am an assistant county attorney in the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. I am the legislative liaison for the office, but when I'm not doing legislative work, I'm a trial attorney in our Child Protection Division. Last night, the committee heard a bill about the decision about whether to remove a child from their parents or not. Tonight's bill is about what happens after that decision has been made by a judge when a child is removed from their parent. When that happens, we do want children to be in the best home possible. Currently, Minnesota's foster care licensing system prevents children from being in their ideal homes. We have a preference in law that's been explained that when children can't be in the care of their parents, that they should be in the home with a relative, a home that's familiar to them rather than go to a stranger's home. We know that because children, and we see this in the courtroom, children do better when they're placed with their relatives. Unfortunately, there are times when decades-old criminal convictions or even charges will prevent relatives from being licensed for foster care. This is true even if that individual has been rehabilitated, if they're productive members of society, or if those exact same crimes would not prevent the child from being adopted by that individual if parental rights were terminated. We also know that the criminal justice system has a disproportionate effect on communities of color. And we know that the child protection system has a disproportionate impact on communities of color, thus compounding the issue when it comes to relative placement. That's why I want to thank Representative Hollins for authoring this bill, House File 1287. In short, as has been explained, it aligns the adoption and foster care licensing standards much more closely, actually. It makes sure that past criminal history is considered when deciding whether to license a foster home, but it's not necessarily determinative of whether someone could be licensed for foster care. It makes sure that if someone does have a criminal history, that they have been rehabilitated, that they are now employed or involved in their community or church, and that they've received any services or treatment that's been needed. It requires, rather than just looking at someone and a conviction on a piece of paper, that the social worker goes into the home, that they observe whether this individual can actually provide care for a child. The bill is the result of a many years long negotiating process, and we've wound up in a really good place. It's got a wide group of supporters, and so I would encourage you to support the legislation. I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have, but thank you for having me this evening.
All right, thank you, Mr. Page. And that is it for testifiers. I do know we have quite a few people on hand from DHS with questions, but I do want to get to the A3 amendment first. I believe that's a Representative Scott amendment. Representative Scott, do you want to move your amendment?
Madam Chair, if I could just speak to it first. Is that all right?
Yeah, please go ahead. Yep, please go ahead, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is, you know, my attempt to address the seriousness of the information that's contained within these background checks. Really sensitive information, as you know. And my concern was that when it's being shared with other government entities, that audit trails and so forth were created so that there were protections and people could go back and find out who their information has been shared with, that sort of thing. And I spoke with DHS last night, and I believe Autumn is on the call. Did I see Autumn is on the call? Anyway, it sounded like adding this language was going to add a significant fiscal note to the bill. And there were some other issues because the FBI and the federal government are involved with these background checks. That sort of made it unworkable. So I don't know if somebody, yeah, there's Autumn. If Autumn wants to address some of those issues that we came up with so that committee members could better understand, I'm gonna withdraw the amendment, but I want her to kind of articulate why it doesn't work with this particular bill. If that's okay, Madam Chair.
Okay. Yep, no, that sounds great. I'm glad that you were making some phone calls and having those conversations. That's really helpful to know who to call on. So is it Autumn or Ms. Modi that wants to take that answer?
I will actually take that, Madam Chair.
Okay. Yep, please introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Scott. My name is Kulani Moti and I serve as the Inspector General at the Department of Human Services. And this is a little background within the Office of Inspector General. One of the divisions is our background studies area. And so wanted to share just some of DHS's concerns that we had about this. And do want to note that we appreciate and thank Representative Scott for continuing to work with us on this amendment. It is overly broad and would apply to all of our studies, and it would be very costly to implement, but understanding that this is sensitive information and wanting to know what we currently do in order to protect the data privacy of these study subjects. So currently, all of our background study information that is through our Net Study 2 system, it's the system that houses all of this, is limited to business needs, even within the agency. So staff that that have business needs must request the access, and then access is restricted to specifically what work that they are on. And all staff that do access our Net Study 2 system are required to take specific training that specifically addresses background studies data, criminal history information, and FBI data. These restrictions do comply with all of our requirements under the Minnesota Government Data Practice Act, as well as our federal laws for compliance with the FBI. Just to let you know that DHS is audited every 3 years by the FBI to ensure that we're in compliance with their data protection and privacy laws, and that we have and know who is accessing our system when we do send out systems, who it's going to, why, and what authority we have to share that information. So I just wanted to provide a little bit more information about what our current practices are. Thank you.
Right. Thank you. That is unique to some of these issues that have come up in similar bills. Any follow-up, Representative Scott?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that explanation, Ms. Modi. I guess I just wanted to again draw attention to the importance of keeping the data safe, and it sounds like there's at least policies in place to make that happen. And I had another thought, but it's escaped me now. It's been too long of a day, but thank you, Madam Chair, and I will withdraw the A3 and look forward to working with DHS in the future. Oh, I know what I was going to say. It came back to me after I was sharing with Autumn and Ms. Sommerfeld last night on a call that several years ago, I asked for a similar language, for some data sharing for indigent people. And it's like, just because they're indigent doesn't mean that their data shouldn't be protected. So I said, can you please create an audit trail? And this was probably 8 years ago. And DHS got back to me with a $200 million fiscal note to create an audit trail. I'd never seen anything like it in my life. So what I told them last night is, with this budget surplus, and if the federal government's going to be sending money to Minnesota, then let's update some of these archaic systems, particularly in DHS. And thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I'll withdraw the case.
Thank you, Representative Scott. And with that, we'll go to committee discussion to the underlying bill. Members, are there any questions for the bill author or the testifiers? All right. Seeing none, Representative Hollins, any closing words about your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members. I would just encourage all of you to support this. This has been a project that has been worked on since long before I came to the legislature, and it would be really great to see this finally go into effect this year. I want to thank the testifiers for being here and the numerous people who've been working on this for the past 4 years, I want to say, and Chair Rena Moran for carrying this previously. I would encourage a yes vote, and with that, I would like to renew my motion.
All right. Representative Hollins renews her motion that House File 1287, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Human Services, Finance, and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chairbreaker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling, excused. Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
Aye.
Representative Novotny.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
Okay, that's 15 ayes and no nays.
The motion prevails, and House File 1287, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Human Services, Finance, and Policy. Thank you to our testifiers. Good job, everybody. We're now on the final bill. House File 1559 is a Representative Rasmussen bill. Representative Rasmussen, welcome to our committee. I will move that House File 1559 be recommended to be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. We now have the bill before us, and I understand that you also have an author's amendment, which is the A2 amendment. That gets the bill in the shape that you would like. I will also then move the A2 author's amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. I think we're all a little tired of unmuting ourselves. I understand. Representative Rasmussen, your bill as amended is now before us. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to present House File 1559 today. This bill was brought to me by the Department of Human Services and the Minnesota Department of Health as a critical update to Minnesota's Safe Place for Newborns law. This bill has both agencies' full support, and I very much appreciate their hard work on this important issue. Enacted originally in 2000, the Safe Place for Newborns law allows a mother to safely and anonymously leave her unharmed newborn within 7 days of birth in a medical facility or to dial 911 to dispatch an ambulance for relinquishment. Medical staff will give shelter, health care, and aid to the newborn until transferred to the care of human services. This law is designed to help a mother protect her child when facing extraordinarily challenging circumstances. Simply put, this law saves lives and was passed in response to tragedies involving abandoned infants. I'm here today with House File 1559 to address a few serious problems with Minnesota's Safe Place for Newborns law. Currently, the law does not allow a mother to give birth in a hospital setting and use the safe place protections. Once a mother gives birth in a medical setting, anonymity cannot be maintained under our current law. DHS and MDH fear that this oversight discourages mothers from delivering babies safely in a medical setting, leaving them to deliver alone at home or in another non-medical setting. This bill continues the anonymity protection provided in the Safe Place statutes by creating a process delinking the mother's identity from her newborn through birth records in those situations where a mother relinquishes her infant in a medical facility after giving birth. In addition, this bill also addresses important equity issues facing Native American infants who are afforded protections under the Indian Child Welfare Act and the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act. Currently, the law does not call for asking the mother if the newborn may have lineage to an Indian tribe, and if known, the name of the tribe. This bill explicitly allows safe places to ask for this information and report to DHS, helping to ensure Native American infants are given the protections and rights they deserve. Madam Chair, I have no testifiers today, but staff members from DHS and MDH are available to answer questions as needed.
Great. Thank you for that good summary of the bill. Certainly a very important topic for us to address. And as Representative Rasmussen noted, we've got a couple of folks from DHS here, but I think you did a great job of summarizing the bill. And as I noted earlier today, I trust my members to read their bills. So Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thanks for hearing this bill. It's really important. And of course, we want these moms to deliver their babies in a safe place. And it's amazing that this bill was passed without the forethought of what this bill does. And so I'm thankful to Representative Rasmussen for bringing it forward and for DHS for working hard on this and making sure that, these babies come into the world as safely as they can. And these moms, you know, they're already faced with a difficult choice of most likely, obviously, an unwanted pregnancy. And so I'm glad for this protection for both her and the baby. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Members, any further discussion to this bill or questions? I will just say that Representative Rasmussen and to the DHS staff, I am grateful for the acknowledgement of how important it is that children be connected to their tribe, even if they are not being raised by their birth mother, and how important that is to have that information available to these children as they grow up. So I appreciate the recognition of the special status there. And Representative Rasmussen, any final words on your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to present the bill, and I appreciate your attention to this matter as well. And simply put, the aim of this bill is to protect the welfare of newborns in danger of abandonment, and also to help preserve the health and future of mothers who find themselves in incredibly challenging situations. So I appreciate the opportunity for the hearing today, and I would ask for member support.
All right, I will renew my motion that House File 1559, as amended, be recommended to be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Liebling, excused. Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Mortensen?
Aye.
Representative Novotny?
Bobby, aye.
Representative Farr?
Aye.
Representative Robbins?
Aye.
Representative Fang?
Aye.
And Representative Zhang?
Aye.
There are 15 ayes and no nays.
The motion prevails, and House File 1559, as amended, is on its way to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Members, I was going to say that I should have scheduled more bills, but given our how well we were doing with unmuting and muting ourselves, I'm going to say that this is the best thing that could have happened this evening in a very busy first deadline week. So I thank everybody for their discussion today, and I promised Representative Fraser I would try to get us out of here to still catch that daylight. So members, we will meet at our regular time on Thursday morning, and then we're holding that 5 p.m. slot for what we don't finish. We're still awaiting the actual DE language for what we're hoping to, in House File 1404, which we heard last week, will function as a we'll have a DE amendment, and then we'll have what we're calling a data mini omnibus bill for some a handful of provisions that we previously heard to try to move those things along as they.
Madam Chair.
No fiscal cost to those. Ms. Ghanani.
The DE amendment was actually posted a little bit before the hearing started. So that is up on the committee page now.
All right. Well, thank you, Ms. Ghanani. I was focused on my Zoom and not my email. So so take a look at that amendment, and we will we'll work on that on Thursday. Again, thank you, members. And with that, we are adjourned.